tonight on Arena. Reviews night, we've been watching Nobody Wants This, Grotesquery and Where's Wanda, and we've been listening to new albums from Coldplay, The Smile and Orla Gartland. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Starting with our TV reviews tonight, taking a look at Netflix's latest romantic comedy, Nobody Wants This, starring Kristen Bell and OC's Adam Brody, in an unlikely pairing of a serial dating sex and relationships podcaster with a newly single rabbi. Then there's another unlikely pairing in Disney's Grotesquery when a nun and a detective team up to investigate a series of crimes that have unsettled a small community. And then Where's Wanda on Prime Video, a German crime thriller laced with dark humour that follows the hapless but desperate parents Dido and Carlotta as they search for Wanda, their missing 17-year-old daughter. With me in studio this evening, Dee Malumbi and Chris Wasser, who've been watching all three. And let's start with Nobody Wants This on Netflix. I suppose opposites attract is the basic premise here, Dee, in many ways. Joanne, Kristen Bell, outspoken and agnostic podcaster, falls for Noah. Adam Brody, a non-conventional Jewish rabbi, but their families are not happy and are plotting against the couple. The hot rabbi is alive and well, it would seem, Dee.
Yes, and that is what he's referred to in the series by the teenage kind of Jewish members of his community. So yeah, it's kind of, it's a very, very sweet show, I have to say. I absolutely fell in love with this. I ended up just binging all 10 episodes in a row. They are about kind of 25 to 30 minute long each and just flow into each other so nicely. And yeah, you mentioned there the leads in it, Kristen Bell and Adam Brody. They have terrific chemistry in this, I have to say, and they're extremely charismatic in their respective roles, and the series, much like its leads, is just very funny and very charming.
Yeah, 25 minutes or 20 plus minutes an episode, Chris.
Perfect.
You do find yourself going, I'll watch another one. Yeah. But it's 12:30, you need to go to bed. Just watch another one.
How many weeks do we sit here and give out about the length?
I know, dramas, 52 of them a year.
I was quite glad to see it. Is there enough story there for the 10 episodes? Maybe. I was kind of thinking at some point this would have made for a lovely little 90-minute or two-hour romantic comedy, but the story is refreshingly straightforward. You know, it doesn't complicate things. You know, as you say, Joanne is a sex podcaster. She runs this podcast called Nobody Wants This with her sister Morgan, played by Justine Loop from Succession. Their podcast kind of thrives and also survives on the stories from their perennially disastrous single lives. So they need to have, you know, all of these disastrous dates. So the last thing they need on the eve of a major acquisition where they're going to make an awful lot of money from their podcast series is for Joanne to meet and fall, you know, for the man
properly
of her dreams.
In love, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that is the hot rabbi. That's Noah Rockoloff. And Noah, played by Adam Brody, played brilliantly by Adam Brody, he has just come out of an almost engagement. He had a case where his girlfriend, Rebecca, essentially found the ring that he was going to use to propose and propose to herself. And it's on that day that he realizes this is not what I want. And at a dinner party a couple of weeks later, he realizes that it's Joanne, that he wants.
And here they are. She goes along to see him preach the way you would.
Yes.
And afterwards, she's been waiting outside for ages for him to come out because he can't come out because all the entire community want to talk to him. But eventually he does come out. And we find out that, in fact, he knows her podcast and has been listening to it.
I'm sorry. I don't know why that pissed me off so much. So dumb. You're just like this serious rabbi, and I'm complaining about a podcast where, honestly, we do talk about sex a lot.
Yeah, I know. I listen.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
To which episode?
I listen to Dildos and Dildon'ts.
Okay.
Learned a lot.
That would not have been my first choice for you.
Really?
Just so you know, sex isn't like the point of the podcast.
Yeah,
does
I get
make
that.
Sense?
Yeah. I feel like you just want your audience to feel as comfortable opening up as you do.
Exactly. I want them to feel empowered.
Plus, now I know what to dildo. And dildo.
Sure, how could you not fall for him? That's Adam Brody as Noah the rabbi and Kristen Bell as Joanne the podcaster in first episode, in fact, of Nobody Wants This. And it is obviously about the two of them, but there are all sorts of little complications around them, and the sister is an interesting character in how she slightly controls, and you know, she's saying we have a podcast here. Get rid of this love thing. It's not useful at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And her sister actually is very kind of cynical and suspicious of Noah, quite irritated by him. And I think kind of irritated by the fact that Joanne has now actually found love and found happiness. She's like, you're meant to be cynical like me and not actually find a romance in this world. And as the series progresses, we kind of learn a little bit more about their family background that might kind of explain why each of them are the way they are. Joanne, for example, has kind of this complicated family background whereby her father is gay, but he and their mother still have this kind of relationship. They're still on good terms and speaking with one another. And it almost seems like she may still actually be in love with him, which is
as in the mother.
The mother might still be in love with the father. Yeah, yeah. So that's all quite awkward. And then you've got Noah's family, who are very Jewish. And actually the series, the only kind of criticisms I have seen aimed at the series is that maybe it leans a little too heavily into like Jewish stereotypes. But he is a brother, Sasha, who's kind of one of the main characters in it, although personally I found him kind of being like less likable. But he's castrated by Noah's sister-in-law, Esther, who's quite intense. And then they both, that's Sasha and Noah, have this kind of mother who's a very strong matriarchal figure who really runs the place and kind of has the
on the subject of that potential stereotypes that are in there. I mean, they're stereotypical podcasters and mouthy New Yorkers as well, for certain, in the case of the two the two sisters. But this is based on a true story, the writer tells us.
Loosely based on the story of
Erin Foster. I wonder how her in-laws feel about that.
She has come out and said that she does have a better relationship with her in-laws. The person we're talking about is Erin Foster, who was an actress who was actually in The OC with Adam Brody 20 years ago, which is terrifying. But she is a writer now, and she met her future husband, Simon Tickman, who is a record label owner 10, 12 years back, something like that. And she converted to Reform Judaism.
Yeah, not
Simon.
Quite a rabbi.
A hot record label owner instead. And she decided to put her story down on paper. And she is well aware of the fact that, you know, the show, people either love this show, or some of the reviews have pointed out that it does kind of paint these cartoonish stereotypes of a Jewish American family. But she is saying that she doesn't find anything wrong with it. And I kind of agree with her here, because it's a heightened comedy. It's taking a real life story but not making a drama out of it. And it's sort of kind of adding fictional conflict and absurd melodrama to the mix to make something that is not mean spirited at all. Maybe is a little bit, you know, some of the jokes in it are a little bit, you know, some of the jokes in it should have died out with the dinosaurs. Let's just put it that way. But most of it works, and I think the reason it works is because of those two leads.
And I must say, I'm very interested to see where the brother character is going to go. Sasha, and now he is a bit of a nasty bit of business, but he is very much under the thumb of his wife. But here is a scene where all four, the two brothers, so the hot rabbi and his rather tedious brother, and the two podcasters, are in the car together. The sister, the Joanne Loop character, plugs in her phone to charge it, but forgets that when she does that, her messages are going to be played back to her.
Oh, I need to charge my phone.
I need to charge my phone too. What percentage are you on?
No, you're not borrowing my charger.
Jump in front of me. I'm at like 22.
That's plenty.
Connected. Message from Morgan. He's cuter than I expected. Oh. He doesn't look that Jewish.
Oh my God.
Morgan. Sorry. Next message from Morgan.
My God. Stop.
The brother is brutal.
What are you doing with the screen?
Ogre emoji.
Okay, that's not.
Vomit emoji.
Morgan, turn it. Unplug the phone.
It's kind of akin to leaving the message on the phone about the person you meant to tell somebody else something about, but you end up saying it onto their message machine. That's a scene from Nobody Wants This, and the sister's phone, Joanne Loop's phone, and Timothy Simons, the brother, Sasha, hears everything that she has to say about him. It's very hard. I take your slight reservations around the stereotypes. It's very hard not to like this and just to want to go home, as I do tonight, and watch the remaining episodes of it.
It's full of those kind of funny, awkward moments like we would have listened to there. Like one bit I love is when Joanne is forced to buy a dildo mid their very first date together. Her and her sister are reviewing it on the podcast as a part of this big deal that they have going on, and the sister absolutely can't make it down to the shop, so she's forced to drag Noah down to the local sex sex shop to buy this dildo. Yeah. And there, I won't give it away, but there are some like awkward encounters in there. We'll just say that. So it's very funny. It's very charming. It's full of this nice core kind of feel good nature. I find it very irresistible and enjoyable. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 stars.
4 out of 5. I found out what a shiksa was. I never knew that before. As you tell me what it is, Chris, and your stars.
Yes, Noah's family referred to Joanne as a shiksa, which is a Gentile blonde, basically a woman that you do not want their son to end up with. The charm and the chemistry between Belle and Brody, who are friends in real life, is the reason you should keep watching the show. I just wish that Erin Foster, who writes the first two episodes, had continued writing it all along, because the first two episodes are terrific. Everything after that gets a little bit ordinary, but still, it's probably the sweetest, funniest thing I've watched in a while, even with its many stereotypes. So 3.5 out of 5.
3.5 out of 5. That is what is it called? It's called Nobody Wants This. It's available right now, all of it, on Netflix. Let's move on to Disney and Grotesquerie, new horror mystery from Ryan Murphy, creator of classics such as American Horror Story and Monster. Of course, this series tells the story of an alcoholic detective, Lois Tyson, played by Niecy Nash, who teams up with a nun, Sister Megan Duval, Michaela Diamond, the actress here, and they investigate a string of heinous crimes inspired by passages in the Bible. You know, even as I say that last bit of the sentence, the crimes here are horrendous. And of course, you know, it's going to be linked into Romans 6 or whatever particular chapter that this nun is going to know all about. It's very graphic and it's quite disturbing.
Yeah, I don't know about anyone else, but whenever I watch a Ryan Murphy show like the one we were reviewing last week, Monsters, whenever someone walks into a dark room where a crime has been committed, I always say to myself, don't show it, Ryan, don't. And he always shows it. He always goes far too far with it. And it's a shame too, because there's an interesting story here about a troubled detective who is having a rough time of it at home. That's Detective Lois Tryon, played by Nash Betts. Her husband is in a coma, her academic husband, who she had an awful falling out with before he was ill. Her daughter is eating too much and is obsessed with auditioning for this show, for this reality TV that focuses on and maybe makes fun of overweight people. And she is also an alcoholic, and she's kind of starting to lose her grip on reality, and she might need to get it together, because there are all of these gruesome crimes happening around her area where it looks as though that we might have a serial killer on the loose. And the massacres, they all are linked by these odd religious themes. I mean, the first one is a family who were tortured and butchered. The second is drug addicts whose bodies were drained of all their blood. And it's actually an outsider, a nurse played by Michaela Diamond, who comes in and says, you know, this is linked to this passage in the Bible. A journalist nun, which is new to me in terms of you know, fictional crime on by Ryan Murphy. But you know, Lois is not the kind of detective who would usually let an outsider stick around, but she's actually getting close to the killer with the help of the nun.
All right, well, let's have a listen to how they meet, the nun and the detective. Yeah. Niecy Nash and Michaela Diamond in their first meeting.
Detective, there's some nun here to see you. Says she's with this Catholic news service or something.
A reporter nun. Sister?
Thank you, yes. I'm Sister Megan. You made time for me.
I really didn't have much choice. Can't turn away a nun at the door. Our dear Lord and Savior might swoop down and kick my ass for that. What is it I can do for you? You have information about the Burnsides?
No. It's hard to explain. Is there somewhere we can sit? I could buy you a coffee if you have the time.
I don't.
She talks straight, does Detective Tryon, played by Niecy Nash, and Sister Megan, played by Michaela Diamond there. And there is, it's certainly the kind of, she at some one point along the way, Tryon says something like, she's looking for theories from the nun, and she says, go on, give me your Lacey and I'll be Cagney here. I mean, there is a touch of the pairing here that has something interesting at the heart of it, Dee.
That's a stretch, I think. I mean, it's also incredibly unbelievable, the fact that
suddenly
the detective
she's allowed
brings
to do everything,
the nun into all of this. It makes absolutely no sense. And why her superiors allow her to bring in the nun makes absolutely no sense. So I get what you mean about them trying to make something heartfelt, I suppose, in that relationship. But I didn't really get anything from it at all. I found everything about this show absolutely repulsive. And it's like, I get it. The show is called Grotesquerie. Everything about it is supposed to be grotesque. grotesque, be it the alcoholism of our protagonist. We eventually see the nun kind of develop this strange relationship with this priest character, Father Charlie, who's played by Nicholas Alexander Chavez, who actually plays one of the Menendez brothers.
Which we reviewed last week, actually.
That's right. Yeah. So they develop this kind of creepy relationship, which initially starts as just a mutual obsession with true crime. He's actually the editor of the paper that she writes for, but then turns into something like kind of sexual. And it's just all very gross and weird. We also have this nurse character in it who is played by, in fairness, the always on point Leslie Manville. Like, I can't see that actress ever turn in a poor performance. But she at some point sexually assaults Lois's husband, who is in a coma, who she's meant to be caring for. So it just really hits you over the head with, I suppose, the whole idea is that this is meant to be repulsive and shocking. And by the end of it, you just find you're not even batting an eyelid anymore.
Well, I am going to play a clip here because the visuals in it at times, as you said, Chris, I mean, the opening scene, we're brought into a place where a family has all been murdered and we see way too much. It's totally unnecessary. So much could be left to our imaginations. Here's a clip where what turns out to be a collection of body parts stitched together has been found, and Lois comes in. Her police colleague, Ed, played by her police colleague here. I'll come back with his name in a minute. Her police colleague is telling her, "You need to step back from all of this. It's way too difficult.
You are not in control. You reek of vodka, which is hard to do. Lo, stay away. Go home. Sleep it off. I'm sorry, but I have a duty to the force, to the community."
Exactly who in the community do you have a duty to, Jack? Jessica Hope? You got a duty to her? Drea Rhimes? NeNe Lynn Taylor? Danny Cotter?
Who are you talking about?
Them! The body parts! How dare you not know who they are!
There you have Lois, the detective character there, Lois Tryon, played by Nicey Nash in Grotesquery, and Jack is the police colleague's name, played by Joshua Bitton. It really does bang you over the head.
It really does, yeah. And the dialogue too. The dialogue in Ryan Murphy shows sounds cool the first time you hear it, but then when you actually think about it, you're like, that doesn't really mean anything. When Lois is investigating her first crime, one of the cops says to her, "If this isn't a hate crime, I don't know what is." And she says, "A hate against what?" And he says, "Everything." And it's like, okay, yeah, it sounds cool, but again, it's so senseless. And the performances too range from Nicey Nash Betts. She is giving a nice performance here, and I think it's a shame that she didn't get a different show about a troubled detective whose home life and work life is a bit all over the place, because the silly theatrical horror stuff around it just kind of ruins things. And Leslie Manville, I mean, there's not an ounce of scenery left to chew on after Leslie Manville is finished.
But she chews it very well.
She does. I was wondering to myself, why did she do this? And then I realised probably the paycheck. But there is another performer in there who's making headlines, and will probably drive the ratings up, and that's Travis Kelce. And for people who might not
know,
he's
playing a hospital porter, isn't he?
He's playing an orderly who
Remind for those who are saying, who is he?
He is a very famous NFL superstar. He's also a very talented podcaster, and he is, of course, Mr. Taylor Swift. He is her other half. And he seems like a good dude. He's a great American footballer. He's actually a pretty good broadcaster. He's not an actor, and it shows. I mean, he's difficult not to like here. He's all charisma and all charm, and he enthusiastically delivers his lines on time, and you know, he's enjoying himself, but it's stunt casting, and it kind of spoils it a little bit. It just shows you again, it's just Ryan Murphy just wants to get people talking. He's doing that, but he's not making great television.
Stars.
I just thought it was miserable. Really just charmless too.
Two.
I appreciated that it created that surreal kind of hyper-stylized world that Murphy is so renowned for, but it's shock for the sake of shock, and it's really just hollow in the end. 2 out of 5.
All right, 2 out of 5. Fairly clear where both of you are on that. I think there are a couple of episodes currently available on Disney, and then one every Wednesday is from next Wednesday onwards. Let's move on then to Where's Wanda, Apple TV's first ever German series, German language series that is, in which murder and comedy collide. 17-year-old Wanda, that's of the title, Where's Wanda, has been missing for months. The police have no leads, so her parents take matters into their own hands and start to spy on their neighbourhood with some help from their tech-savvy son. The idea of a missing child and a comedy, it's hard to see how they fit together, But somehow the madness, the madcap nature of this German comedy, does it manage to do it?
I mean, for me, it always felt kind of tonally off because I felt like it should be a kind of hard-hitting drama. And it did seem kind of strange, the fact that it was comedy instead. I mean, one thing that I suppose the audience kind of knows from the outset is that Wanda probably is alive because she's the one who's actually narrating the series. So I suppose that kind of gives you a sense of comfort and allows for those kind of more comedic elements. But for me, I'm not a massive fan of slapstick. And there were a lot of kind of slapstick situations that the parents end up in. For example, we see the character of Dedo, who is the father. He drops mustard on his shirt. He's struggling to use voice notes. At one point, he's meant to be giving this kind of talking on live TV about the fact that his daughter has disappeared and he can't get his seat up properly. The adjustable chair has gotten stuck downwards. But then the mother, Carlotta, she's kind of losing her mind on live TV and she's almost like a bit hysterical. So it was just kind of strange seeing that juxtaposition of, you know, the tragedy of losing a child and kind of the comedic elements. Yeah. I'm not sure if they quite always fit, to be honest.
But that scene that you're talking about, that Dee is talking about there in the television studio, where the mother and father are being interviewed about the loss of the daughter, and you can hear the producer going, close in on the mother. And they kind of play into, it's a pastiche in some ways,
yeah,
and a criticism, an ironic comment on the nature of those particular styles of programmes and trying to get her to cry. That's what they're looking for.
Yeah,
get
that absolutely.
Camera in close so we can see the tears.
I quite like that scene because that scene starts off with there's a reconstruction playing in the background before they're interviewed in this fresh TV appeal, because it's been 70 days, I think, since Wanda went missing. And the reconstruction is so hammy and so cheesy, but you really do get those things on television for missing persons appeals. And when they sit down, they're expected to perform and show more emotion. And there's a really good line in there about, you know, how the mother is saying, you look like a bloody air traffic controller over there, because she's trying to get her to just, you know, amp up
emote
the emotion.
More, please, yeah.
So you do have all of this, you know, farcical physical comedy playing out where the poor husband and the father, is he has too much makeup on, he looks a little bit like Donald Trump, he keeps falling off his chair. But you also have this mother who's just on the edge and is pointing out that everyone keeps asking her, how does it feel knowing that you might not ever see your daughter again? And she just loses it, as you would.
Yeah.
And look, those jarring tones, they do give you whiplash at times, but I do think there is something there. It kind of promises at times something a little bit supernatural, a little bit, you know, there's the comedy element to it, but it's the drama that I'm keeping with, how the family kind of responds, because there's another child there as well.
There's another child in Wanda's brother, who is hearing impaired. And there's also this festival going on in the village, which kind of sounds like classic folk horror stuff. Nippelwerkenach, if I have it right, which basically is a night when this monster comes out of the forest and takes a young maiden from the village off, and they kind of play this out.
Yeah.
But then you wonder, ooh, is there something going on here? But those parents are going to visit every house in the village, and they're going to find stranger and stranger things in every house in a comic way. That's what I presume is going to happen here.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. So they basically enlist their son Ole to kind of help them spy on their neighbours, because they're certain that someone knows something about what happened to Wanda, and they arrange for all these illegal surveillance devices to be set up all around the neighbourhood in the houses. So
they go in and they put a camera in them.
And they're putting a camera in, exactly. So this obviously leads to some comedic situations where, for example, the therapist, you know, has kind of got this strange private life going on. I'll leave it at that. But another thing that kind of frustrated me about this series, and we've kind of touched on, like, you know, the depiction of the media, the supernatural, the fact that they set up these cameras also allow them at one point in the series to kind of, you know, be do-gooders, and they almost like save this young woman's life practically. But I felt like everything felt a bit kind of slightly underdeveloped or something like that. But at the same time, there was enough of a hook in each episode to keep watching, so I'll give it that.
Yeah, so you will stick with it you might stick with it, is what you're saying. Stars on
this? I'd give it 3 out of 5 stars. Like, I did find it was kind of picking up pace and interest as it went along. I liked it, I didn't love it.
Okay, 3. What are you saying, Chris?
German language series, which we should add, created and written by an Englishman. I'm not really sure what happened there, why, you know, because at times it doesn't really kind of have have that German sense of humour. Maybe a little bit more of a German sense of humour would have helped. It is quite playful, as I said, a little bit tonally discombobulated at times, but the performance has kept me in. It's its own worst enemy. I don't like it jumping all over the place. That non-linear storytelling, that needs to go. We need to stop seeing that in these kinds of shows, because there's a straightforward story here. It should stick to it. 3 out of 5 for now.
3 out of 5 for now, but your mind has been kept open. Yeah. First 2 episodes of Where's Wanda are streaming on Apple TV Plus right now. New episodes every Wednesday for that. Finally, a quick mention for the 3rd season of the Netflix teen drama Heartstoppers, starts streaming today. Garnered quite a fan base with its uplifting portrayal of young queer romances. Do you like this series? What do we need to know? Can we just dive into season 3 if we haven't seen seasons 1 and 2?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, essentially the series kind of follows the burgeoning relationship between Charlie, who's played by Joe Locke, and Nick, who is played by Kit Connor. But it follows the relationships between their friends as well. I don't think you necessarily need to have seen previous episodes, but you will get a lot more out of the series as a result of it. This show just has such enchanting characters, tender love stories, heartfelt themes. This season in particular kind of explores more mature and complex themes than ever before, such as mental health, eating disorders, intimacy and sex. And it's, you know, it's kind of one of those shows. It's interesting because it's actually targeted at young adults or teens, but I am an adult and I absolutely love it. And I know a few fellow adults who love this show. It's a great one, I think, for everyone, but particularly for parents and kids to watch together. I think it's a real conversation starter as well.
Oh, that's an interesting take on it. We certainly wouldn't have the kids anywhere near grotesque or evil.
No, even though it's on Disney Plus, yeah, do not watch.
Do not go anywhere near it with children in the house or watching the telly with you. Stars for Heartstoppers.
Oh, 4 out of 5.
For a good love solid it. 4 out of 5. Heartstoppers season 3 available on Netflix today. Where's Wanda? Apple TV Plus. 2 episodes available right now. New episodes every Wednesday. First 4 episodes of Grotesquery, if you can manage it, are now streaming on Disney Plus, with new episodes dropping every Thursday through until Halloween, the 31st of October. Maybe there's a hint in there. And Nobody Wants This, streaming now on Netflix and will be on in my house when I get home later on. Thanks to Dee Malumbi and Chris Mosser for reviewing our TV highlights for this week. And so on to our album reviews on this Friday evening. We have new releases from a global titan, an indie upstart, and an experimental supergroup, Coldplay. Not the experimental supergroup. The British mega band formed by Chris Martin returns to Moon Music, their 10th studio album. Career spanning over 2 decades, reputation as one of the most successful bands of the 21st century, known for anthemic stadium-filling sound, as witnessed in Croke Park last August. But can they still innovate, or have they become formulaic? Orla Gartland is an Irish singer, rising star, offers her own brand of indie pop with her latest album, which is called Everybody Needs a Hero, gained widespread attention with her 2021 debut, Woman on the Internet. And finally, The Smile, project formed by Radiohead's Thom Yorke and Johnny Greenwood, continues their exploration of avant-garde rock with their latest release, which is called Cutouts. With me in studio this evening, Cian Sullivan and Zara Hederman. We're going to start with Coldplay, but first of all, I want some statistics from you, Ms. Hederman, if you wouldn't mind. How many people attended the Coldplay concert?
Well, with a capacity at 82,000, that would make approximately 328,000 people. And if you would like another statistic,
please.
Sean, this album got an advance of £35 million, which is the highest for any album of all time. So that would go into recording sessions, sample clearance, and who knows what else that £35 million went to.
Well, let us listen to one of the tracks on the album called We Pray.
Brother is blessed, praying for enough, pray Virginia wins, pray I judge nobody and forgive me my sins, I pray we make it, pray my friend to pull through, pray as I take it, listen to others, I do. Praying on your love, we pray with every breath. Though I'm in the valley of the shadow of death. And so we pray for someone to come and show me the way. And so we pray for some shelter and some records to play.
So we pray, and I've been praying all day. That has been going around in my head like an earworm because there's a very familiar song in my head that I keep singing every time I hear it. Now, I know it's a familiar chord progression, but nobody has been able to identify it for me yet. 51551, by the way, if you can identify it for me. That is We Pray from Coldplay. Huge success. Sarah gave us the statistics there on those that attended the concerts, Cian, which she also told me was 15% of the population of the Republic of Ireland, which is quite a statistic when you actually think about it. I have to check your maths on that one, but I'll take it at face value. These guys are hugely popular, but any time a person, a music critic comes into this studio, I feel the noses going up in the air straight away.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been quite widely critiqued over the time. I mean, I guess they kind of followed in that pattern of Travis, of this kind of more slow, laid back, and which kind of was catnip, I guess, to people who were kind of more of a rock leaning. And they've kind of gone from a band into a boy band. Like they've gone from Travis to Take That almost in that kind of trajectory. And they've only amassed fans as they've gone along, it seems.
It would certainly seem. I see. I've noticed that you've avoided the answer to whether your nose is going up in the air or not.
No, my nose isn't going up.
Are you going to be honest about where
yes.
your nose is on this one, Zara?
I remember being in here with you, actually, Sean, 3 years ago for the previous one, Music of the Spheres. And actually, I feel that we need to correct ourselves. This album is actually called Music of the Spheres Volume 2, Moon Music, because it does continue on with some of the very celestial John Hopkins production, which I think they're trying to impress us with. And certainly, I do think John Hopkins, bless him, does do a bit of a job at making you maybe listen to this. But then you get something like we heard, We Pray, which has features of Little Sims, Burna Boy. To have someone like Little Sims on a song, who is such an incredible artist, and to have such a paltry feature, I think is actually just inexcusable from Coldplay. And I think last time when I was in doing Music of the Spheres, we talked about how Coldplay have really turned into a very commercial prospect. Like, listening to this album, there was nothing here that I felt was very exciting or very original. It was very much chase the money, don't really worry about the creative expression. And thankfully, I did see that Chris Martin had announced that Coldplay will stop after 12 albums. So we're on album 10, so we have two more to go.
You've still been quite nasty about it all. You reckon, I think, Ian, that Chris Martin is trying too hard in terms of trying to garner fans and listeners in the Gen Z.
Well, yeah, they just, like Sarah said, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of money thrown into this. There's Max Martin, the pop empresario, is producing here. John Hopkins is kind of cool. I counted 58 additional technical, hands on this album, and 74 additional musicians playing on this album. Why?
There's a big orchestra there. So there's 50 or 60 musicians for you straight away.
It's just, you can make an orchestra smaller in the studio. You know, that's why you don't need all these hands on deck. And it doesn't necessarily sound like it. Another thing is, of the 44-minute runtime, 18 minutes of this is basically instrumentals, which, nothing wrong with an instrumental track. I just also don't think it plays to Coldplay's bass necessarily. Like, this music is kind of scoring a planet Earth, you know, sequence of a dolphin eating a fish. You know, it's just, it's a weird move for them, and I don't know who it's for.
All right, let us listen to a one-word title. Feels Like I'm Falling in Love, because it is all down as one word, all lowercase, of course.
I know that this could hurt me bad. I know that this could feel like that. I just can't stop. Then my defenses drop. I know that I was born to kill any angel on my windowsill, but it's so dark inside.
Breaks it up into two words there. Feels like I'm falling in love from Coldplay. Lyrically, in terms of the what he's talking about there, when he, that part of the first verse when he says, I'm la 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 la, what do you think he's singing about there, Zara?
It's hard to know, to be honest, because it could be interpreted like text messages. It's hard to know the tone, really. That, to me, felt that he didn't have anything to say and was filling the space, because he does say la 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 again on All My Love. He has a kind of yodel again as well on one of the songs.
But you do know if they come back to Croke Park, the 380,000 or whatever that figure was that you gave, yeah, will be
la, la, la,
screaming
back to him. But,
and that's what they do. They give us big anthems that we can sing back to.
Yeah,
or with.
They do. And like listening to this as well, there is that song and also Good Feelings. I felt that Chris Martin had maybe just watched the Barbie film and felt a bit angry that he wasn't asked to contribute to the soundtrack and he was doing his versions.
And your evidence for that?
Listening to the song.
Okay. Stars from you, Zara.
I just thought this was a mess, and also to have a song titled just a rainbow emoji didn't really do it for me either, so it was a 1 out of 5 for me.
1 out of 5.
Well, that song's actually called Alien Radio / Alien Hits, yeah. So I don't know how you'd know that with just the rainbow emoji.
Yeah, and it is the one that's pretty much instrumental
and
the whole
way through.
It
has Maya Angelou on it, if you can believe that. Look, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a big pop product, and I think some of those songs will sound great in the stadium when they do their 10 night run at Wembley. It's just not overly interesting, I think, and I think they've done their fans a bit of disservice having so much filler, so I went for 2.5.
2.5. Okay, neither of you very happy there, clearly. Moon Music, to give it its shortened title from Coldplay. Let us move on to album number 2, Everybody Needs a Hero, from Orla Gartland. I'm going to go straight. No, actually, tell me a little bit, Zara, about Orla Gartland before, because she had such a big hit with the first album, didn't she?
Yeah, and really fascinating when you look at her rise to stardom. Like, she started on YouTube when she was 13. She cultivated a huge following. She released her 4 EPs, which were all critically lauded. She was called one of Ireland's most influential teens. And then she released Woman on the Internet, which was hugely successful. And I think really announced her to a more mainstream audience outside of the online culture that she had created. I also think it's very interesting how she has shown aspiring artists that you can do things in a DIY way. She set up her own label, New Friends, which she put this album out as well. So very fascinating kind of profile to look at. She also, after Woman on the Internet, instead of to try and maybe avoid the difficult second album, she started a supergroup side project called Fizz, and they released an album last year. So
yeah, it's a lot going on there. There's no la 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 in the lyrics of Orla Gartland's songs, or there might be, but if it's there, it's there for a reason. Let's have a listen to a track called Backseat Driver. Bit of an intro on this one, if I remember right, but the lyrics are worth waiting for.
No one likes an angry girl, no one likes a liar. Likes a conversation walking on the wire. I don't know how he got here. Next thing I know, told a version of the truth and it got out of control. Guilt is like a bad apple rotten to the core. Backseat driver, this has gone too far. You've taken up enough space, now get out of my car. Cause there is only one way that this is gonna go. 90 miles an hour flying straight into the wall.
There we go. Backseat Driver, the title of that song from Orla Gartland. And you were wondering why I was why I was having so much fun. I just find those lyrics really inventive, Kate.
Yeah, yeah. I think she's really grown in confidence since the debut, and I think she's also grown in her production style. Like, there was so many fun kind of just little ear candy moments in there, yeah, little percussive hits across the record that I think is a real great demonstration of how she's grown in, you know, as an artist. And yeah, I've really enjoyed listening it across all these tracks.
And in terms of the production, is she still using that kind of DIY mentality within it, or do you sense more production on this album than there was perhaps on the first?
I feel it's less insular, as in, I think, you know, obviously she comes from, I guess, a bedroom pop perspective, yeah, and I think she's beginning to see further reaches. Whether she makes it on her own, I know she only has like two producers working on this with her, so it could be still very DIY, but I think she's making it sound like there's a lot more hands on deck.
Yeah, it certainly sounds that there's a bit more money underneath, yeah, the production, apart from anything else. But maybe that has come from the success of the first album. Declan McKenna is on a track, on one of the tracks with her here as well. Zara?
Yeah, he's on Late to the Party, which when I listened to it immediately made me think of, say, Orla Gartland, but going into that kind of Billie Eilish world, almost a bit darker. Even the lyrics reminded me of Billie Eilish, you know, the room is falling around me, I'm clinging to the car seat. Very visceral, very visual. But to talk about the, like, the bigger production, and Late to the Party has that as well. It's in a similar kind of key to what we heard. I didn't really love that because I felt that some of the reference points I kept thinking of, say, like mid St. Vincent career, which just to me felt a bit tired in 2024. And pop at the moment is so strong. We have so many big characters doing such interesting things that sometimes I felt like the difficult second album wasn't completely avoided.
Let's listen to a little bit of Late to the Party.
See, I don't like to think about your lovers who came before me, but I know they exist. I got away. I got problems to pick with all your lovers who came before me. Okay, so maybe Rachel was right. Everybody just walks all over you, and now when we fight, I am on your side. See, I wouldn't bite or try to change your mind. The room is falling around me. I'm clinging to the car seat. To the party, let me go back, shake her hand. I wanna give her my thanks for the damage she's done.
There we go, a little taste of Late to the Party from Orla Gartland and her new album Everybody Needs a Hero. Overall, did this work for you, Kane?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I take Sarah's point that it, you know, it isn't necessarily moving the dial on contemporary rock music, but I think at the heart you have some really great pop hooks that have me ensnared all week, especially a track like Little Chaos I've been listening all week.
Yeah.
And lyrically, I quite enjoy the journey she's been going on, expressing, you know, the challenges within her long-term relationship, and I think by the end she sort of realizes that she's grown, and I think the kind of sonic evolution matches that as well.
Stars from you.
I really, really enjoyed it. 4.5.
4.5 from Kane. What do you think, Sarah?
I actually quite preferred the quieter moments on this album. And there's one, The Hit, which I really liked in particular. And I liked it when it's just her and maybe a piano or a guitar.
Yeah, there's a couple of songs where it's a bit more pared back.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's one of the last songs, Mine as well, I thought was a really superb moment on it. For me, though, I just felt that there wasn't enough push forward on it. So it was a 3 for me.
A 3 from you. Okay, we have one more album to go. The Smile with their new album, Cutouts. And we'll be talking about that after these. Sarah Hederman and Kane Sullivan still with me, and we're on to our third album, Cutouts, the title of the third album as well, from The Smile. The Smile being Tom York and Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead fame. I'm going to start with by listening to a track called Tiptoe. Quite a long introduction on this one, but it is Tom York and it is Johnny Greenwood, so I think we can bear it. Thank you. Some point along the way, that is the opening section of The Smile, one of the tracks on one of the tracks on Cutouts from The Smile. You are very keen, Zara, that I credit all three members of The Smile, so you better do that because it's not just Radiohead.
Yeah, poor old Tom Skinner getting left behind there, who is a very accomplished musician in his own right, was a drummer in Sons of Kemet, came up through the London jazz scene, and I think adds quite a nice looseness to Johnny Greenwood and Tom York's otherwise very obviously Radiohead centric sound. This is their third album, their second this year, and as we heard there with Tiptoe, they're joined on all three of their albums by the London Contemporary Orchestra, who give, I think, the best extra kind of oomph.
Yeah, conducted by Martin Ames, who was on this programme a couple of weeks back, wasn't he? He was talking about video games and music attached to it, and he had real oomph in terms of what he was talking about. That orchestral thing adds hugely to this album, Cian.
Definitely. It really helps expand the sounds out and really creates the world as well, because other than the songs that have guitar, normally when they have guitar they have a lot of it, there's not a whole lot of like solid surfaces on this. It's quite gaseous. It expands a lot. There's, you know, dissonant horns coming out of nowhere. There's these sort of shrill synths at times that often don't resolve. And yeah, it fills a lot of space, and a lot of that is helped with those violins that you hear there go from. I really like the transition where it starts really warm and then it gets gradually more eerie as the track goes on. Spine tingling.
I want to listen to a little bit of another track. This is called Colors Fly. This brought me to the desert. Colors Fly, kind of Arabian desert feel to that. Just to the rhythms on the guitar, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like a snake charming vibe to it as well. Yeah, really gorgeous.
Yeah. Does this album work for you? I mean, it's a big listen across the 10 tracks, but you kind of have to give it time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I enjoyed it. I think they're having a lot of fun. I think the fact that they've got two albums out in 1 year shows they're in a real creative boon at the moment. I think they're really having fun. Production is their playground, it sounds like, on this. They're trying different things, and a lot of them are working for me. I find some of the more, I think the kind of two opening tracks, I think I would have spaced them out more. I think when you hit Zero Sum as track three, that pulls you into it. I think they could have spread that out more, but like that's just a sequencing issue. Other than that, I thought there was some really interesting sounds on this.
Does it feel like Radiohead in a slightly different remixed format, or is there enough of a difference there for you, Zara?
I mean, for me, there's elements. I mean, some of Thom Yorke's lyrics, like you get Windows 95 repeated ad nauseum. That's a very Radiohead-esque thing. There's also a song, Bodies Laughing, which Radiohead Reddit users will know is actually a song that Radiohead have had in their catalogue from 2005, but has never been recorded. So that was nice to see that. But I think what we heard there, even with Colours Fly, that's a very Johnny Greenwood solo pursuit when he does like his film work. There's some stuff here actually which, instead of Radiohead, it really reminded me of, say, like Thom Yorke's Suspiria soundtrack work, which he did with Sam Petts-Davies, who produced this with them. He did Suspiria soundtrack with Thom Yorke. So I did feel that there was quite a lot of offcuts from their different projects in this, which for me wasn't as exciting to listen to repeatedly. I mean, we can't deny it sounds great. Was I going to go back and listen to this as a huge Radiohead fan? Not really. Like, the Smile albums don't excite me too much. The one actually before this, Wall of Eyes, I think is the best one. But if you want to explore it, like, absolutely. Yeah. As we heard there, there's great sounds.
Yeah,
with those
plenty
strings
to hear. Stars from you, Zara?
It's a 3.5 out for me. I really want Thom and Johnny to go back to Radiohead after saying.
We'll let them know your desires, Sarah. And Kane?
I give it a 4. I really enjoyed kind of just exploring the worlds that they created with
him. All right, a solid 4 from Kane on that one. Kane Sullivan and Zara Hederman, our reviewers on this Friday evening. Cutouts, the name of the album from The Smile, Everybody Needs a Hero from Orla Gartland, and Moon Music from Coldplay. Texter suggested that We Pray sounds like the Pet Shop Boys, It's a Sin. Don't think that's what I'm thinking about, but it has a flavour of that about it. And also, I should correct myself. Robert Ames is the title of the conductor that I was talking about earlier on with the London contemporary group that are involved in the Smile album. That is our lot, I think. It is for this Friday and for this week here on Arena. Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Pauline McNamara. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.